Change we can believe in.
Thank you, Brother Lou, and good morning, brethren. Sister Karen and I are very glad to be here. It's been an oasis away from the world. And actually, it's Change We Can Believe In, Part 1. And the method to my madness is if you like it, you'll have to invite me back to hear Part 2. Actually, it started off with two thoughts in I wasn't able to combine them into one talk, so I narrowed it down to one. So we're going to talk about changes in the world that we see today in relation to our chronology and prophecies. So let me ask, brethren, do you like change?
No.
At least you're being honest. Some people are excited by continual change. Some would prefer that their lives would and the world around them would never change but remain constant and steady. Many find change to be stressful and alarming and upsetting. When we consider the time in which we are living and observe the world's daily affairs through various media, it's easy to become overwhelmed by all that is occurring. The world is changing at a relentlessly fast pace. Things are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up. Even ancient traditional countries, and we were talking about this, our fellowship, which was I thought was amazing. Even traditional countries that have somewhat resisted modernization, like China, India, and those in the Middle East, seem to be changing overnight. Some in the world see this as progressive, others as destructive. However, none really feel any peace of mind and feel a bit of fear. It may even be that we as Bible students view the barrage of change out there and feel a bit of fearfulness or unsure about the upheavals we see all around the world. But we need to stand back and view this from a spiritual perspective. We need to look at the vast changes in recent history from God's standpoint, not mankind. So let's ask three important questions. When did these changes begin? And I'm going to deal with specific changes. To what are they leading? And is it a change we as Bible students can believe in? Now obviously, the talk was kind of taken off of Obama's campaign slogan, which was clever, I thought. But, you know, the world makes promises that they can't keep. So we know the world has been slowly changing for 6,000 years, but over the past 200 years, we have seen special historical changes in every quarter of life, technology, economy, education, etc. But there has been one change, I think, that is most noteworthy, and that is the spread of individual liberty and freedom to the common man. Those ideas we take for granted here in this country that were embraced so long ago by America and Europe continues to spread even today. We think, you know, it was all done years ago, but it's continuing. And are now reaching every corner of the globe. Should this surprise us? Should we be surprised by this? Isn't the ushering in of the kingdom of God an exercise in liberation? And we're not the only beneficiaries in this country. At times, history looks chaotic and we shudder at the thought of revolutions, but revolutions must come, and the old order must be completely removed so the foundation of God's righteous kingdom can be laid. Justice to the line, and righteousness to the plummet, where all will eventually be truly free and truly liberated from sin. And while this has not fully come to pass, if we trace the changes over the past 200 years, we cannot deny there's a trend in this direction. For example, the recent uprising in the Middle East, beginning in Egypt, then spreading to Libya and Syria, is being instigated not by outside threat, but by their own people. And I think this is kind of unprecedented in that region because they have such a lock on people. These governments who for centuries controlled the people through corrupt and oppressive means are beginning to lose their grip, can no longer operate as they have in the past. What did the people want? What is the core of their demand? More freedom, more liberty. Where are they getting these ideas or even the courage to demand them in those regions? Among other places, I think the most prominent is the internet. Not only is the internet becoming a global source of knowledge, but it's also a powerful tool that any individual can use. The whole world is now able to record and upload images, sound, and video directly from their cell phones, and the people rebelling in the Middle East are using the internet to upload mobile videos of government abuses, thus embarrassing and putting pressure on them to either stop or be criticized by a global community. Have you ever wondered at the scripture, Michael shall stand up and knowledge shall be increased? Generally speaking, the world has been growing in knowledge since Adam. So why is the increase of knowledge specially mentioned in Daniel 12:4? Because knowledge is power, as they say. Prior to a couple centuries ago, knowledge for the masses was suppressed and reserved for the wealthy elite. However, over the past 200 years, knowledge has been flooding the world, and now with the invention of the internet, that flood has become a global tsunami. Every one-horse town and backwater burg is being affected by it. Anyone with a connection can now get access to a global think tank. And I work on the internet. That's how I make my living. And so I see various trends on a daily basis, and I'm fascinated. People in oppressed countries can read and even view the freedom and liberties that people in other countries enjoy. And likewise, people in freedom-loving countries read about and view the atrocities in oppressed countries and put pressure on those governments to change. The people are becoming less tolerant of any who abuse authority, even when it's not their country or people being abused. And the weak are saying, banding together and saying, I am strong. How are these hyper-regulated totalitarian governments like China, North Korea, Libya, or Iran going to control people with the ideas of freedom floating around on the internet? The answer is simple. They aren't going to. And they can't if they wanted to. The genie is out of the bottle. Just as the increase of knowledge, liberty, and freedom spread through America and Europe, it is spreading to these other ancient countries with the same results. Just taking a little longer. Think of how much the internet has already changed the way we live, communicate, and do business, and even conduct class, which is a blessing because we have brethren from South Africa join us once in a while. And we're in North America. Theoretically speaking, every person on the planet can now have a direct dialogue with every other person, regardless of country, political view, religion, education, or station in life. Theoretically speaking, I can email people directly now if I know what their email is. I can Skype, I can chat with them directly with no interference from other people, bypassing the government. It will take a while for some of these countries to come around, but they will have no choice. The people will demand it. Also, I've observed another subtle change happening in the world directly related to the internet. For the younger generation, the internet has become a daily part of life, and we've seen that yesterday with my niece. From a young age, they're able to chat and collaborate with children all over the world. They're able to collaborate musically, scientifically, politically, artistically. Whatever interest anyone has can be shared by other people with the same passion all over the world. I communicate with developers from India, from China. We're on forums and things like that. We share knowledge. Whatever interest anyone has can be shared. And since the internet is uniquely American, English has become the standard by which people communicate, which means language barriers are being diminished on a grand scale, effectively reversing the confusion of language at the Tower of Babel. And I went to a convention one time. We had international developers. They spoke better English than some people in America, which stunned me. And I asked them how they spoke such good English. They said they watch American TV, and they are on the internet. So, amazing. What effect is this having on the younger generation and people in general? The internet's been out for a few years. Now we're starting to see some effects, right? What are those effects, especially with the young generation? Politically speaking, they no longer see themselves merely in a national sense, but are beginning to see themselves more and more in a global context. They're looking outside themselves and realizing that we are all interconnected now, and while having different cultures, they recognize the same basic human interests and needs. While globalization will bring various problems, and it is, it really shouldn't come as a shock or upset us that things are moving in such a direction. Don't we expect the Lord's kingdom to be on a global scale? The sooner the world starts viewing each other as one people, the easier it will be for them to adapt when the Lord fully sets up his new world order. See, the world thinks they're going to set up a new world order. But to help illustrate the point of the weak saying I'm strong, I have a newspaper article here that I happened to come across while working on this talk, fortuitously. On the front it reads, petition drives for a global community. Okay. The article is about a new company started about 4 years ago by a Stanford graduate who wanted to help affect social change. He said that while in college, he and his colleagues cared about many different things but felt powerless to change the things they wanted to affect, or that they cared about. And the article claims that his site is revolutionizing the way ordinary people can affect change by starting online signature campaigns that target lawmakers, the lawmakers that deal with that particular type of change they want to make. And what's unique, and they'll target companies and even nations. Okay, so what's unique is I think that staff helps people target those people, find out who those people actually are and target them. So there's facilitators. They're not really necessarily in agreement with all the petitions, but they figure if you can get enough signatures, that there's enough people interested in making this change, then let's target the lawmaker and see if we can get it changed. They say no issue is too big or small. All they do is provide the tools, and it's up to the user to petition. We could go on there today and petition for more Bible study, you know, probably signed by all the brethren in the United States. Might get a lot of nominal Christians, too. They've already experienced cyber attacks originating from China, which they believe are in response to one petition on their site signed by over 140,000 people to free a highly regarded Chinese architect and artist who was detained for criticizing the Chinese government's stance on democracy and human rights. And he's the guy that built the bird nest, or designed the bird nest stadium in China for the Olympics, last Olympics. So the whole world was petitioning. I mean, people around the globe are petitioning. So what's interesting about this, guess what day I found this paper? July 4th, Independence Day. I didn't even notice until I got it home, and Karen says, hey, did you see the date on this? Independence Day. So I don't think it was an accident. So seeing where we are today, let's ask our first question, when did these changes begin? When did, and specifically, when did the quest for individual freedom and liberty first manifest itself? And how? We believe the American Revolution in 1776 was a major influence in breaking the long-held grip of autocratic rule, which encouraged others in Europe to follow suit. But America, as we know, is a side story. Europe is the real focus. Their change began in 1799, as we know. And why is that date more significant than the others? So let's review a little history, a little European history, and this will probably go right along with your fourth volume studies, I hope. Maybe, hopefully it'll add something to it. In the centuries before 1799, Europe was the center of the world, not America. Sometimes we forget that, you know. We're so big and powerful. Well, we were once. We'll see where it goes, but we forget that. America was an infant compared to the mature nations of that time. So the European world view at the time was that kings ruled the people by divine right, and the priests spoke for God. That's what they told the people, pretty much. If not overtly, they implied it. Therefore, disobeying them was essentially like disobeying God in their view. But here's the real significance of that date. The ecclesiastical or religious arm of those European governments previous to 1799 had legal power to force citizens to comply by law to their religious doctrines. And we were talking about this morning in the fellowship, and I was biting my tongue not to say too much, and I'll give it all away. Give my talk away, not that you didn't already know these things. So they had real legal power. This is significant. We're not talking about just religious influence. Power. They had civil power. Any religious dissension in Europe previous to 1799 could get you locked up or worse, even death. And we know the stories of the torture and things that some experienced. So when we talk about the persecuting church then and the persecuting churches of today, if there are any, there really is no comparison, in my view. No church has that kind of power today, not even papacy anymore. But let's go further back and ask, when did this European worldview begin? And then we'll answer why it's significant that it was there. It began in 539 AD when something seemingly insignificant but very fortuitous took place in Rome that put the Pope of that time in a unique position of power. Before 539 AD, the Papal Church didn't have any power. They didn't have any civil power. All she had was some religious influence among the people, which you might construe as power, but it's not really the kind of power where I can force you to do something. However, in 534 AD, Justinian, ruler of the eastern leg of the Roman Empire, wrote what are called the Edicts of Justinian. That probably came out in the fourth volume. Some of these edicts included laws which greatly favored the Pope and gave him power to arrest anyone who did not comply with Orthodox views of the Trinity and the Mass, and etc. There was only one problem. The Pope was in Rome, which at that time was not under Justinian's control. So it kind of makes you wonder why he wrote the edicts at all. But he did, and he sent them to the Pope. So these edicts were of no immediate value to the Papal Church at that time. They were more like promising love letters before a marriage. So it's kind of almost like a courtship. Here's a little clip about Justinian from Wikipedia, which you know you might want to check a history book, but I thought it was enough information here to make it worthwhile. It says, at the very beginning of his reign, he deemed it proper to promulgate by law the Church's belief in the Trinity and the Incarnation, and to threaten all heretics, even pagan heretics, with the appropriate penalties, whereas he subsequently declared that he intended to deprive all disturbers of orthodoxy, their view of orthodoxy, of the opportunity of such offense by due process of law. This is the key, due process of law. He made the Nicene Creed the sole symbol of the Church and accorded legal force to the canons of the four ecumenical councils. Justinian protected the purity of the Church by suppressing heretics. He neglected no opportunity for securing the rights of the Church and clergy, for protecting and extending monasticism. He granted the monks the right to inherit property from private citizens and the right to receive solemnia or annual gifts from the imperial treasury, so that now they're being supported by government, or from taxes of certain provinces, and he prohibited lay confiscation on monastic estates, so you couldn't confiscate their property if you were a lay person. This is a pretty good deal. I mean, you know, if you were part of that orthodoxy belief, you'd be happy. Again, Justinian wrote these papal supporting edicts in 534. However, the Pope at the time was in Rome under a different regime known as Ostrogoths. And there were actually the Ostrogoths, and there were a couple other little kingdoms, the Huleries, Hulari, and another little kingdom that were associated. What was it? I was hoping there was some history buffs here, but I couldn't find a way to word it in here nicely, but Ostrogoths were the big guys, and they had two little guys with them, okay? Visigoths, that's it. Okay, so as if by providence, Justinian dispatched a general to negotiate a treaty with Ostrogoths that same year. So 534, he writes the edicts, then he sends General Belisarius, go negotiate with the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths a treaty. And what he really wanted was them to be a border state so that if they were attacked, they could fight for him. But the general didn't like the deal, and he ended up actually conquering them instead against Justinian's orders. So after decimating the ruling elite in Rome, the general was called back to Justinian, probably to give him a what for not following his rules. But nevertheless, it kind of worked out in Justinian's favor. So when Belisarius, the general, was called back, he left the city without a loyal or qualified leader to govern the city except for one person. The Pope, who had enough influence among the people and enough loyalty to Justinian to do the job. So through various political and military machinations, the Pope ended up as governor of Rome almost by default. Since Rome was now fully under Justinian's rule, all those edicts of Justinian that favored the papal church written 5 years previous went into full effect. Now those love letters became contract. Now the Pope had real power. He was backed by civil law, which gave him power to arrest any who did not comply with church doctrines. At that very moment, the little horn with eyes, as mentioned in Daniel 7:8, popped up. From then on, that little horn grew and grew for centuries into the church-state relationship we recognize as spiritual Babylon, or as Daniel 12 describes it, the abomination that maketh desolate. Why was it named so? Because this new power brought spiritual desolation to the world. They claimed to be the light of civilization, yet some centuries were so spiritually desolate and dark that secular historians dubbed them the Dark Ages. And you know it's bad when the world is calling you dark, you know? There are types in the scriptures that speak of this time as a drought and famine in the land for the hearing of God's true word. And we see Amos 11 through 12, and 1 Kings 18:2, and you can look at the comments on that. That could probably be a whole nother talk. So was the church ever left in ignorance about any of this? Not only was the early church warned by Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 that a great falling away would take place, but it was prophesied as far back as Daniel that it would happen. All we had to do was wait for the prophecies to be fulfilled so that we could understand them. Looking at historical events surrounding 539 AD, we see that they fit two specific prophetic conditions in Daniel 12:11. First, the prophecy says there will be a turning aside of the daily sacrifice, that is, the Mass, which denies the power of Jesus' original continual sacrifice. This doctrine was actually adopted many years before 539, and somebody mentioned a book that talks about this. Is that you, Sister Betty?
Well, we were talking about the Reformers and their stepchildren this morning.
Okay. Some good reading on this subject. As far as the church, the early church transforming into this nominal church. The second condition mentioned in Daniel was the setting up of the abomination of desolation, or man of sin. And I've been hearing that in the conversations. Papacy is the only system that fits this description, in my opinion. Papacy was not set up through her own power, but set up by Justinian. Even though they were courting the power, Justinian set them up. Therefore, her pastor uses 539 instead of 534 as the date that meets these two conditions, because 539 marks the date when the Pope could actually exercise civil power, not before. So I have heard brethren use 534, or the secular historians use 534 as the date. The Pope didn't have any power then. 539, he had power. That being the case, 539 AD also marks the date when we can start counting the 1260, 1290, 1335 prophetic days of Daniel. But for the sake of time, we're going to focus on 1260 days mentioned in Daniel 7:25 and 12:7, because these speak to the time permitted by God for the papal church to take a crack at creating a Christian kingdom on earth without him. They had a little time period they can take a shot at it. So for 1260 years, they were permitted to meddle in civil affairs. 1260 long years of spiritual drought until when? Daniel says until the time of the end, or time appointed. End of what? Appointed for what? A time appointed to bring an end to papacy's power. A time when the clay would be dissolved, leaving only the iron of civil rule. So if we take 1260 and add it to 539, we end up back at 1799. What happened in 1799 to end the special ecclesiastical power? Napoleon, a man who had no respect for religion and only believed in himself, performed such a successful coup upon the weak French government of that time that he became the most powerful man in the world. Once in power, he immediately stripped the papal church of her civil powers gained through Justinian way back in 539. And for the first time in over 1,000 years, the ecclesiastical head of the European governments was severely damaged. Why is it significant that this happened in France? It's significant because at that time, the French nation was the most loyal country to the Pope. For papacy to lose power and favor in France was to lose the crown jewel of her support. All the other nations would follow suit. And we have Revelations 18:9, and the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning. So they saw it happening. Her power was stripped, and she was actually, the church was trying to get that power back. They were doing everything in their power to get power. From 1799 onward, papacy's glory diminished rapidly. This was the time of the end for her. This was the time appointed for her to lose her standing in the world. She tried to garner her favor back by continuing to support the kings, croaking like frogs, the Revelation 16:13 scripture, that their divine authority, the divine right of kings, and for the people to obey those two. So they were basically, they were acting like cheerleaders. Hey, kings, we're still with you. Hey, you know, we still like you. Obey the kings. How about throwing us some of that power back? You know, how about supporting us as well? But the kings were kind of, nah, we're moving on. Don't think we're going to go back. Because they were getting rich at this time. And we'll explain why. In 1860, the Pope got into, now this is between 1799 and 1914, 1860, the Pope got into a military tiff with Victor Emmanuel, who drove him and his army all the way back into the small corner of the world known as Vatican City, where he remains today. So that's how Vatican City ended up Vatican City. Victor Emmanuel pushed him all the way back into that corner. They used to have all kinds of land and riches, which they still do some riches, but nothing like they had before. What is significant about papacy losing her standing and influence? So why is this even being mentioned? What does it have to do with us or the world or anything? For 1260 years, the church kept a lid on individual liberty of thought and freedom of religion. For 1260 years, what was those old pressure cookers? Put the lid on. Kept it all regulated. And in 1799, the lid was coming off. You ever see the lid come off of one of those things? My grandmother almost blew a hole in the roof making soup one time. So now for question two. Where was this change in religious worldview leading? In other words, what happens when the stifling shackles of religious control are removed from society? Here's what the pastor expected to see after 1799, and this is from the third volume, page 23. The time of the end, a period of 115 years, from AD 1799 to AD 14, is particularly marked in the scriptures, the day of his preparation. That's another name given to it. Because in it, a general increase of knowledge resulting in discoveries, inventions, etc., paves the way to the coming millennium of favor, making ready the mechanical devices which will economize labor and provide the world in general with time and conveniences which under Christ's reign of righteousness will be a blessing to all and aid in filling the earth with the knowledge of the Lord. We can see that a lot of media channels can very easily be used in that capacity right now. And it is a day or period of preparation in another sense also, for by the increase of knowledge among the masses, giving to all a taste of liberty and luxury. Before Christ's rule was established to rightly regulate the world, these blessings will gradually become agencies of class power and will result in uprisings of the masses and the overthrow of corporative trust, etc., with which will fall also the present dominions of earth, civil and ecclesiastical, and thus the present is a day of preparation through such an overthrow for the establishment of the universal dominion of the kingdom of God so long prayed for. First, end of quote, by the way. First, what does the pastor mean, present dominions of earth, civil and ecclesiastical? And I think this needs to be emphasized a lot, because younger generations like myself, we grew up in America and we're used to how things are today. We forget how they were 200 years ago or 100 years ago, and need to study that history to make sense of the pastor's chronology. Remember, this paragraph was written in 1890, not 2011. What was the political world like in 1890? And specifically speaking, what was it like in Europe? Not America. In other words, why not consider Japan, China, India, or even America? Because none of those countries claimed to be Christ's kingdom on earth, ruling in his stead by divine right. None of those, America didn't claim that, Japan didn't claim that, but Europe was claiming that. Ancient Rome was claiming that. So God was going to deal with that. And while the ecclesiastical branches of the church-state system was severely undermined in 1799, the civil branches, the kings, were alive and well all the way up to 1914. So the present dominions of earth in the pastor's day and the present weak, sickly, socialist, communist, capitalist governments of today are so drastically different they cannot be considered in the same context. I've heard brethren talk about financial king, the ten toes being financial kings in the world today. No. We're talking about kings in Christendom who claim to be there by divine right back in the pastor's day. So consider the fact that in 1890, Russia was not communist but was ruled by Tsar Nicholas II. England, as it is today, didn't exist, was ruled by King George V. Germany, only recently united after being carved up in World War II, was then ruled by Kaiser Wilhelm, who is credited with instigating the First World War. Austria was then ruled by Kaiser Franz Joseph, Italy by Victor Emmanuel, and the list goes on. All claim to be Christ's kingdom, all claim to be kings reigning by divine right. None of those royal families rule today. None of them. Neither does, and you know, you want to claim England's royal family, they're just figureheads. They don't rule the country. Neither does the Pope dare claim today that Europe is Christendom or any of Europe's leaders rule by divine right. They'd be laughed off the TV channel. We might go so far as to say the governments formed post-1914 are fragmented ruins of that old Babylonic system, but in reality they are completely different arrangements and are nowhere near the kind of glory, power, influence that those kings and priests of old wielded. So we must understand when reading the studies in the scriptures that when the pastor is talking about Babylon or the church, state, union, or ecclesiastical and civil powers, he was specifically referring to the governments in Europe that had existed in 1890, not the impotent, broken fragments that came after 1914. Those old pre-1914 church governments were indeed overthrown, never to rise again, because their lease of power was up, as mentioned in Luke 21:24. We're not going to see that again. And then Hitler tried. That's what Hitler was trying to do. He was trying to bring back that old glory. And the Lord didn't allow it. He came close, but the Lord did not allow it. I wanted to put that in here, but that was what Hitler was trying to do. He was trying to gobble them all back up, reestablish that Romish kind of government. Not going to happen. So the pastor mentions in volume 3, in that quote, a general increase of knowledge, inventions, class struggles, and revolutions. And if not for the prophetic timing, you might think all this is just a matter of course if you're not really paying attention. But the individual liberties gained in America and those after papacy's fall in 1799 removed the suppressive restraints on society. The general increase of education and knowledge that followed produced wide-ranging effects. The newfound freedom and liberty helped elevate the world in general to new heights. This is why knowledge is mentioned when Michael stands up. Because the increase of knowledge resulted in more labor-saving inventions, which in turn blessed the lower classes, which in turn brought economic political power to the lower classes, that when not dealt with properly by the ruling elite, resulted in revolutions. So the knowledge was the beginning. It was the beginning influence. And now this knowledge was filtering into the world. The church was out of the way. They couldn't control it anymore. Society started rising up from the bottom up, which put pressure on the elite to deal with them, because now they had power, they had strength. Have these things actually happened? And just to prove the point, here's an interesting modern summary by a Dr. Harold Demereau, Senior Professor of Government and History at Union College in Cranford, New Jersey, from his website. And I just picked a random historian to show how you could almost take his word. This is a modern commentary on that time. You could take these words and plug it right into the third volume. It says, throughout the 19th century, and that's 1800 to 1900, so 1799, 1800, 1914, this period of time, conservative kings and aristocratic advisors remained in power in most European states. But the 19th century was also a century of progress, peace, and tremendous social change. The Industrial Revolution, which had begun in England during the second half of the 18th century, that's the 1750s, spread to the Netherlands and France, and there from Germany, Northern Italy, and the United States and Japan. By the end of the century, it was beginning to have an impact on Russia. The substitution of machine labor for human and animal labor constituted the most important social change, in my opinion. That's in his opinion. The Industrial Revolution has undergone a number of stages or phases and is still evolving. The first phase was from about 1750 to 1850. Coal and steam engines were dominant driving forces of this phase. During the second phase, steel, oil, turbines, electricity, and internal combustion engines replaced the simpler technologies. Wooden sailboats were replaced by diesel-powered steel ocean liners and battleships. Between 1815 and 1914, no major world war disrupted the general progress of economic development. By 1914, this is still him talking, almost all the world was under European domination. By 1914, almost all the world was under European domination, either directly as colonies or indirectly as colonial offshoots, which had been founded by Europeans and gained their independence from their mother country, like the United States, South America, republics. Chinese, Japanese, and the Ottoman empires, while remaining independent, were under tremendous pressure to modernize or be subjected to European domination. So they were forced to modernize or be dominated. They had no choice. So even the changes that were happening in Christendom were impacting the rest of the world. Within the European states, industrialization was producing new social classes. The industrial bourgeois, that's a fancy word for middle class, and the industrial proletariat, fancy word for wage earner, which we take for granted that we're wage earners now, but that was a new thing back then. You were either a subsistence farmer or under a feudal lord of some kind. So it was a new thing, and it was having an effect in society. The forces of democracy initiated by the American and French revolutions continued to demand an end to aristocratic rule. Class conflict and mass ideologies were prominent features of the 19th century. Nonetheless, the traditional monarchies, not presidents, not prime ministers, the monarchies, and their landed aristocratic allies continued to rule in most countries of Europe at the end of the century. But everywhere, the bourgeois, that's the middle class, was gaining economic strength and demanding its share of political power. Unsuccessful revolutions had broken out repeatedly throughout the century. Monarchs and aristocrats were being forced slowly to make accommodations not only to the bourgeois, but also to the rising working class. So here's the class system layers being set up. Used to be elite, peasant. Now we got elites, middle class, working class, peasants. Despite all these issues between 1799 and 1914, the European Christian kingdoms grew extremely rich, but instead of progressing, they were being crushed by the weight of their own wealth and pride. They were all interrelated and jealous of each other. Instead of creating a Christian utopia from all their newfound blessings, they created a time of trouble the world has never seen. Just think a battle where every so-called Christian kingdom of Europe engaged in a single horrific war. Now. But at that time it was Christendom. But now, instead of running people through with bayonets, not batons, bayonets, they had newly invented weapons of mass destruction to mangle their fellow Christians with. This indeed confused many religious people of that time and made them ask the question whether these were really Christian kingdoms after all. Within 4 years, there were 37 million Christian on Christian casualties, with 16 million deaths, 21 million wounded. Then, due to the mixing of soldiers from every country, the flu pandemic broke out, killed another, they estimate, 50 to 100 million people. And that's where we can bring in Zephaniah 1, 15 and 18 through 18. A day of wrath is that day, a day of adversity and distress, a day of waste and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of cloud and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and of shouting against the fenced cities and against the high corners. And I have sent distress to men, and they have walked as the blind. For against Jehovah they have sinned and poured out their blood as dust, and their flesh is as dung. Even their silver and their gold is not able to deliver them in that day of the wrath of Jehovah. And in the fire of his jealousy consumed is the whole land, for only a hastened end doth he make of all the inhabitants of the land. And then we have Zephaniah 3, 1 through 9. Woe to the rebellious and polluted, the oppressing city. She hath not hearkened to the voice. She hath not accepted instruction. In Jehovah she hath not trusted. Unto her God she hath not drawn near. Therefore wait for me, an affirmation of Jehovah, for the day of my rising for prey. For my judgment is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out on them mine indignation and the heat of mine anger. For by the fire of my jealousy consumed is all the earth. For then do I turn unto the people a pure lip or language, to call all of them by the name of Jehovah to serve him with one shoulder or consent. This is Young's literal translation. I thought it was read a little better. So as we know, the pastor's original thoughts surrounding 1914 were that everything would culminate shortly after that date, including the completion of the church, and that all human government would be overthrown. He confesses in the second volume forward that We could not, of course, know in 1889 whether the date 1914 so clearly marked in the Bible as the end of Gentile lease of power or permission to rule the world would mean that they would be fully out of power at that time, or whether their lease expiring, their eviction would begin. The latter we perceive to be the Lord's program. And the pastor died, as we know, in 1916, before the Great War ended, but his predictions are amazingly accurate. And I know the brethren are very familiar with these quotes here. This is from The Kingdom of God Set Up, reprint 5632. Because certain important things are to be accomplished, we see that God is permitting what to others might seem to be pure human devilishness. For a wise purpose, he permits this reign of lawlessness, this condition which evokes universal odium. Our thought is that we should look for still further evidences day by day that the Gentile times have ended, and that God's kingdom has begun its work. We are expecting to see multiplied proofs of the kingdom power, though the world will not recognize it as such until it is manifested in the flaming fire of anarchy, which is still further along. The present setup is the war of the nations. The next step will be socialism, an attempted socialism among the people. Then the third step, anarchy, will gradually come on. When this symbolic fire shall prevail, then the world will realize what we have been trying to tell them now, namely that God's kingdom is taking control, and that these various demonstrations are evidences that our Lord is taking his great power. But the many will not begin to see it until the flaming fire is revealed. When we endeavor to tell them now, they will not receive it, but they will be thoroughly convinced when they see the destructive fire of anarchy. Of course, this is back in his day. It is merely during... I think since I'm running out of time, I'm going to skip some of this and move along. I think enough has been said on the pastor's thoughts there. So, the question I want to ask is, how did God crush these kingdoms? How did he bring about the time of trouble? Did he rain fire and brimstone upon the kings in 1914? Nope, they did that all by themselves, applying newly acquired knowledge to all manner of death-dealing machines. Was there lightning and thunder in the sky to wake nations out of their beds? Only the muzzle flashes created by those same war machines. So what did God do to assemble the nations to battle? Did he drag them there kicking and screaming? No, they were more than willing to fight. Their pride could barely wait to conquer a rival nation. So what did God do? He blessed them. He blessed them by allowing an increase of knowledge. This knowledge brought about inventions, which brought about fabulous wealth, which brought about what? Liberty and justice for all? Brotherly love? Paradise? Not even close. No, all this fabulous knowledge and wealth only induced the nations to envy, hatred, and strife. Because of sin, the self and selfishness, instead of all these blessings ushering in paradise, it caused them to implode on themselves. All God had to do to bring these proud kings and nations to their knees was to bless them bountifully and allow their own selfishness and wrath to bring about their own destruction. This is how God uses the wrath of man to praise him. And this same principle is still active today. But now, instead of crushing mountainous kingdoms, it is crushing all the little fragmented nations until they are dust. Is God personally causing trouble in the world today? No. He has a great army of people all over the world willing to do the work for him. If they only knew how much service they're doing for God to help usher in his kingdom, they would probably quit out of spite. How does the Lord get them to work? He continues to bless the people with more freedom, more liberty, more knowledge, more money. However, instead of stopping at some kind of sane equilibrium, mankind will continue it like a runaway train until all that remains is the anarchy of human passions. And with newly invented communication devices like the internet, those passions can now be shared and expressed and proliferated across the globe. just as we're seeing in Libya, Egypt, China, and now we're seeing it in London, which was, they believe, was sparked by the Twitter. Here's a quote from Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google, and I was telling Karen this. I had this thought about the internet. I was telling Karen it, and I couldn't express it, and then I saw a news article where this guy made this quote. And I thought, okay, I'm not the only one. The internet is the first thing that humanity has built that humanity doesn't understand. The largest experiment in anarchy that the world has ever had. That's the former CEO of Google. So looking over the past 200 years, it may seem strange that the very blessings that are uplifting mankind and setting them free from parts of the curse are also causing the breakdown of long-established vain imaginations, oppressive governments, false doctrines, and beloved institutions. Anything that can be shaken will be. And yet, while we see the shaking, we are at the same time continuing to see wonderful kingdom preparations on a global scale. Individual liberty and freedom are improving globally. Knowledge is increasing globally. People are connecting and helping each other to some extent globally. General wealth is continuing to improve for the lower classes in what were traditionally poor countries like China, India, and South America. Mankind is trying to solve many difficult problems, but they're trying to do it without God, and like many doctors today, merely treat the symptoms, not the disease. And we know what the disease is. It's selfishness. So while people today are generally living better lives compared to 1799, instead of being satisfied, each successive generation begins at a higher standard than the one before and fully expects to improve upon the standard of living of their progenitors. And I know some of you who've lived a long time can see this. Instead of feeling appreciative and indebted for the blessings they now enjoy because of the sacrifices and battles of the past, there's a sense of entitlement. And I see this in college all the time. Selfishness knows no limits. It's no longer what can I do for my family, for society, for government, but what can I do for me? And this is a general statement. We don't want to indict everyone. There's some good people in the world. But in general, this general attitude pervading society is so strong it is affecting everyone, even those who would prefer it otherwise. So little by little, each successive generation is inching toward the pit. Matthew 24:22, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So why is God permitting these things to happen? This is from reprint 1692, and it's actually off topic. The actual topic of the article is different than what these paragraphs say, but I couldn't believe what I was reading. Man's experience is now being so arranged for him as to bring to the masses the proof that selfishness is not the proper motive power. He's bringing the proof. The welfare of all being considered, it is not the proper motivating power. Because in the present condition of physical and mental inequality, the mental and physical strong would get all there is, while the weaker and imbecile would be wholly dependent upon the charity for existence, for their charity for existence. And as the ratio of difference would continue to increase, it would mean the ultimately the wealth and government of the world would all be in the hands of a few intellectual giants. And even if all men were mentally and physically perfect and equal, the result of the operation of selfishness would mean a continual strife for mastery, greatness, power, and advantage, which would mar the bliss of paradise. So it doesn't work. So now we come to the final question. Is all this change we as Bible students can believe in, truly believe in, even though we participate in some of the globalization problems? When I used to set tile for a living, we would go into people's houses and show them pictures of what their kitchen or bath could look like with various designs. And they would get all excited and see the pictures and couldn't wait to get started. And then after all that was done, we'd sign contracts and put a plan together. We'd show up one day and proceed to destroy their house, tearing out the old tile. And some of the homeowners would become extremely nervous at this point,
even to the point of having misgivings about the contract they agreed to. And some wondered if we knew what we were doing and if we could actually repair the damage done. Some would become very impatient with their house being in disarray and project their frustration toward us. This would carry on for a few days until finally we began rebuilding their kitchen and made it look 10 times better than before, and then they were happy with us again. So with that picture, God has promised us a plan for mankind. We don't want to be like those homeowners with God's promises. We don't want to lose that enthusiasm we had when God first showed us the pictures of his plan. We don't want to have misgivings about the Lord's ability to carry out his designs. We don't want to doubt the timing of the chronology as set forth by the wise and faithful servant, or disbelieve the prophecies just because we are impatient that the world is in disarray for so long after 1914. And we yearn for the mediatorial phase of the kingdom, which seems delayed. God is right on time, even if we aren't. The old foundations must be completely removed. There's nothing graceful about the demolition process. It's dirty, disruptive, and laborious. Ultimately, mankind will learn that selfishness is not the right motivating principle for the good of all. After the demolition is complete, then God will turn to the people of pure language, that they may all call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent. So, brethren, the current troubles, as burdensome as they are, and the disturbing changes we see in society, are changes you can believe in. God is not delayed. He is right on time and fully in control of the matter. All this demolition of institutions are ultimately leading to the laying of the foundation of God's kingdom on earth. And after that, onto restitution of Adam and his family, which we all hope to help facilitate if found faithful to our covenant. May the Lord add his blessing.